Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy, for what you do and spreading the word, because I think that listening to somebody else that's done what you're planning on doing kind of takes some of the pressure off, because you see people that have done it their own way and you can pick an idea up here or there. Because there is no one way to do things. Everything I've learned is through either experience or other people's experiences. I mean, I learned a lot in college, but I forgot most of it by the time I got out because it was rote memorization. But when I got into, you know, IBM and the Fleetwood, that's when I really learned about business.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. Thank you for tuning in for a third conversation with multi-venture entrepreneur Skip Thaler, our guest mentor. He loves the challenge of starting and growing successful new businesses. He's hardworking, generous, and competitive, prospecting and capitalizing on opportunities in the marketplace to create new business has been the lifeblood of his success. And you've been hearing a lot of success. It's very uncommon to have this much financial success consistently with every venture that a person jumps into. Skip was raised, as you heard in our first conversation, in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, as the eldest of four children. His father was influential in his successful entrepreneurial journey that began in the 60s. Skip married his childhood sweetheart, Jill Kroll, and was blessed to have raised three adult children, George, Sarah, and Tim. They now have seven grandchildren. Skip's undergraduate degree was earned from the University of St. Thomas, St. Paul, Minnesota in business and economics. His master's degree is in international business from Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and he was able to, 30 years later, brush off his knowledge of international business and really learn a lot to run an intercontinental marketing company. His first job out of school was in sales with IBM. He left there to start a manufacturer rep business selling Fleetwood tires. And that led to the most successful Fleetwood franchise in the United States. He created a brokerage tire business to sell discontinued and blemished tires that grew into a $13 million in sales per year business. This financial success positioned him to merge his company with Tires Plus, combining the sales volume at that time to $25 million. At Tires Plus, Skip worked to help grow the business to $50 million, selling his ownership in 1991 to his two business partners. Semi-retirement allowed Skip to pursue his love of sailing and found an international tire wholesale business, Intercontinental Marketing Corporation, or IMC. While upholding his five-year United States non-compete agreement, this company provided him another opportunity to see the expansion of how tires can get shipped from one country to another, the blemished kind. IMC is the birthplace of three pledges Skip made to himself. No more hiring of W-2 employees. IMC will not carry accounts receivable, and he will not own inventory. So keeping faithful to his three promises, Skip prepared his company for George, his son, to join him in 1998 to learn the tire trading business. They diversified into motorcycles and used truck tires casings for retreaders. That business generated in excess of $10 million in sales per year. Uniquely positioned in the marketplace, they kept their expenses under 8% of their gross profit. So 92 cents out of every dollar went to the bottom line. In 2012, his other son, Tim, joined the business as Skip transitioned into a new business, the business of acquiring brownstone apartment buildings in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And this is where we left off in our conversation. At the end of our conversation, our second conversation, you heard Skip talk about kind of what he've learned about setting boundaries and about transitioning from one generation of business to another. And what worked really well for him is that George, his eldest son, had his own book of business. And so he was able to work with him on letting go of his part of it and trusting that he could build out the business in a unique and different way. So he learned that there's more than one way to run a business. Boundaries work really well. And his other son, Tim, on the IT path, also continues to help George out, which kind of fulfills a good way in which they're running the business right now. Although Tim is on his own path in Seattle, they do find ways to work together. Is that accurate, Skip?
Yeah, I think, business generation standpoint, but from a financing standpoint, working with the banks and so on.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Absolutely. Yeah, because there's a lot of banks you need to work with in order to make these tire trades happen.
Well, not only that, but sometimes you need to finance for working capital, and that does help. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for joining us as a guest mentor, kind of digging in further into your life as you're shaping. We're talking about the windows of opportunities that presented themselves and how you thought about them and how you transitioned. And you're an extremely quick learner because having an international business is very complicated, and to work with so many different countries. Yeah. So you seem to be great at juggling lots of activities. What's your secret?
Good question. Hard work and passion for what I do. There's really no substitute for the fact that when you do not have a support staff around you, and everything still has to get done, you have to dedicate yourself to the fact that you're going to spend more than 8 hours and sometimes 12, 14 hours a day doing what you know you can do. The beauty is you get paid for exactly what you do. Okay, if you're successful in creating sales, then you'll get paid for it. If you're not, then time takes care of itself, and you don't stay in the business because you can't afford to. And I've always had the philosophy that life is short, and I really don't want to waste any of it, and that goes both for working and for my family life and my recreational time.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit of the shift in time. So like when you gave over the reins to George of IMC, that created lots of room in your schedule.
Mm-hmm. I did not make a conscious effort of any of this. It's not something that, I sat down and says, okay, now I'm not going to do this, I'm going to do this. I have, my family tells me I'm obsessive and compulsive, which I am. And that is when I see an opportunity, and I saw an opportunity in real estate. It was really interesting. This is still while I was running IMC. I was investing part of our retirement money in CDs. We had them in a CD ladder. In other words, you buy 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year CDs, and they mature. As they mature, you buy another one so that there's kind of one maturing, say, in this case, would be once every year. And we were getting paid like 4 or 5% on those in the retirement account. And I can remember looking at that, and then I thought, because I had some real estate. I had some duplexes and fourplexes, but I was very passive in it. And I had paid off the mortgages on them because of some changes that were done in the tax law in the middle 80s. And I was looking at the amount of money I had invested in those properties, and I was looking at the net income I was getting back, and it was closer to 8%, okay? So I said, well, here I am in contract for deeds. I get 4% in apartments. I get 8%, and that 8% is sheltered income, so you don't pay taxes because the depreciation shelters it. It also is usually subject to appreciation, okay? So it's going to go up in value. And I thought to myself, well, why don't I do more of this with some of our retirement money, is put that into buildings. And with retirement, you got to pay cash. You cannot have mortgages on those. And so I went out and tried to buy more duplexes and fourplexes at the time. And I think this was probably in the late 90s. And what happened was, is by the time I would get to go look at one of these properties, they were sold. In other words, I couldn't move fast enough to buy them because there were so many people trying to buy them up. So then I thought, well, if I go to bigger properties, then maybe what will happen is there'll be less buyers. And sure enough, I ended up starting out with an 8-unit building, and I started to sell off my duplexes and fourplexes because the market was very, very active at the time. And I took the money from them and I put it into bigger units so that I could start to not leverage myself, because, again, I didn't finance. It was all cash. But I could at the same time, consolidate. And then later I started to buy stuff outside of the retirement and leverage it. So that's kind of how I got in it. I remember one day just going out, looking at a building, answering an ad in the newspaper. Next thing I know, is a week or a month later, I ended up owning it. So that's the way it started.
Wow. So you kept building and adding to your portfolio these, were they all 8 complex properties?
No.
Or how did you, so over another 7-year period?
Well, no. In this case, I'd say I started actually back in the late 90s.
Oh, that's right. So 30-year.
You know, I still had the tire business going at the time. And when I, you know, when I finally got out of it, say 8 or 9 years ago, I really then, you know, I had enough mass to keep me pretty busy at that time. But I was doing both in parallel. So it wasn't something that just, you know, I turned one off and turned the other on. It was kind of running two businesses at the same time. And the beauty of that business was I had a management company running the property, the day-to-day operations. And if you look at one of the things, I going back and reflecting on all this stuff, that's kind of a common thread, and that is that I had somebody always taking care of all the details, okay? That is the management, you know, renting the property, collecting the rents, and so on. Then I would watch the financials on a monthly basis. I get a financial report. And I did that, you know, in the tire business. I had a freight forwarder. I had a bank. I had an insurance company. Had a small, a 1099 accounting firm. All of these people that worked for themselves but would do work as you needed it type of thing. And it's the same thing with the management company for real estate. You know, they... In this case, they started out with one property, and by the time I got done, I was with a different management company, but they had 25 properties and over 400 apartments to manage. So, it just kind of evolved.
Right, with time and opportunities that showed up.
And one thing I learned was that they always say, you know, what's the most important thing in real estate? You know what it is?
What?
Location. Okay. Well, I didn't learn that at first, okay, because I bought some locations that weren't so good. And it didn't take me long, and I got out of them. And then I kind of tried to consolidate everything into a particular area of the city so that, you know, they were good locations, number one. And number two, they were within, in St. Paul, I had a 2-mile radius of, say, McAllister College. And then Minneapolis, it was basically an uptown and Whittier neighborhoods. So I wouldn't buy anything unless it was in that area.
Oh, I see. So things started changing in unimaginable ways this year. So by last year, where were you at with your real estate properties?
Well, I bought a building in December of last year over by the cathedral. Okay, beautiful brownstone building built in 1980. They say you should never fall in love with real estate, but I did fall in love with the building and ended up buying that. And, you know, at my age, I should be getting rid of things, not adding to. And, you know, so that was really my last acquisition. But when the virus hit and the riots hit, it woke me up. I loved buying these old buildings and bringing them back to the way they were, but and making it a nice home for people to live in. But a lot of things changed, and my whole attitude and my whole thought process changed along with it.
And what did that lead you to, that change in your thought processes?
Well, I've sold everything in Minneapolis, and I've sold many of the things in St. Paul. But what I found was that at my age, you know, I don't process things as well as I used to, and I have a underlying health issue that does not work well with stress, and it kind of woke me up to the fact that these things that it took me 20 years to build, I was able to sell them in less than, you know, I started selling them in June, and I closed on the last one here about 3 weeks ago in Minneapolis.
And it sounds like a really painful process.
Well, it is, because you put your heart and soul in these things. I mean, I'm just the opposite of a slumlord. I probably put too much money in my buildings. I have kind of a different way of looking at things that than most, say, property owners would do. I have what they call I have a philosophy of a, you know, the building should be a perfect path for the tenant when they come up to the building to rent it. And I created a system, basically, not a system. Well, it's a system, I guess, doing things different than most people that own 100-year-old buildings, because you go in most of these buildings and they're 100-year-old buildings and they look and feel like it. Okay.
Yeah.
So the first thing I would do, I would take and make the landscaping nicer than any of the homes in the neighborhood. So actually, and when you find out when you do that, that these other homes would start to bring the back their, you know, they'd start to spend money on their landscaping more so. Because usually the apartment building is this, you know, the sore thumb in the neighborhood. In my case, I tried to create just the opposite. So I started with that. Then I would put these large metal pots out front, and I would put flowers in the summer. Arrangement of different flowers in them. And then in the fall, I would put mums. In the winter, I put in, just put them in last weekend, Christmas, you know, the evergreen boughs and the,
yeah,
you know, the different decorations. And then in the spring, we put in pansies, so that when the people come home to their home, that they, you know, it just feels a little bit more homey, because now you've got a beautifully landscaped yard. You have large, you know, you have these flowers there that are greeting you. It makes you just feel better. Then the next thing I did was, again, different than most people, was I would take and I would go down to the history museum, and I would go in, and you can search by area and you can search by years for pictures. Okay. So in this case, a building that was built in 1890, what I would do is I would take 5 years before and after. So I'd search between 1885 and 1895 for any pictures of buildings that were in that immediate area.
Oh.
I would have them printed out, and then I'd have them framed. They'd be, oh, I don't know what they were, size-wise, probably 17 by 24. You know, so they were nice size.
Big,
we'd have them,
yeah,
framed, and we put them in the hallways and entryways of the building. So it, again, personalizes a little bit more. And then we'd go in and put in vintage, you know, new vintage light fixtures, remove paint from the woodwork, sand and varnish it, put in new 100% wool carpets. and all of that. And then we would try and preserve a lot of the past in the units themselves, the clawfoot bathtubs, the porcelain farm sinks, the original varnished woodwork and cabinetry, and then clean up the tile and so on. So when they came in, they would have this, what we call a perfect path from the time of the landscaping to the hallways to the entryway into the apartment. And we would try and preserve as much of the past as we could without creating a new building. But I had just basically a simple philosophy: make it like a building you would like to live in. And I always looked at it that way. Would I live here? And we did that. But as a result of a lot of changes that have happened in the last six months or so, it's almost impossible to maintain that.
Because did you receive a lot of property damage?
I did not. I was very concerned. We had a lot of the rioting go on around us, but it never affected us. They never attacked any apartments or buildings because of people being in it. Okay, or in them.
Yeah.
They did burn down some large buildings that were like 80-90% completed, so there weren't people in them. And they went after more just businesses so they could loot. The looting was, we know what it was. So,
yeah. What made you to decide then?
And like I say, as I woke up and looked at my health situation, and then the kind of the crowning blow was, the city governments no longer support business, especially property owners in Minneapolis and in St. Paul to some degree. Just give you some ideas. We can no longer do credit checks on people for, using credit scores to see if they're worthy of paying. There's people that now are convicted felons that get out of prison and we have to rent to them irregardless. We cannot use that as a reason not to. And I'm all for helping people, get started and so on, but there's a process. And you got to let that process play itself out. But they've cut the process down to where I feel that my tenants could be threatened as a result of some of the people that we would have to rent to. We had more exposure to lawsuits. There's all kinds of issues that now we're being taken away from the private property owner and being decided by the government. And then lastly is basically, with this moratorium on evictions, that's fine. I think we should take care of the tenants, but the government should help. And they, for the longest time, would not. They just said you can't evict them, and they did nothing to help the people that were having to pay their mortgages, the landlords, to do that. Fortunately, it did not affect me, but all of these things just added up to say, enough's enough. I'm on my way somewhere else. I'll let somebody else take care of it. But, when you take pride in what you're doing and you have an emotional involvement in making these things really nice places to live and you don't get the support, you feel like you're left out there alone. So.
Yeah, it's really sad. There needs to be a change in Minneapolis and St. Paul because your voice is representing a lot of how business owners feel in those communities.
Well, I think the problem, Nancy, is more deep-rooted is we're only one vote, okay? And there's more votes that are benefiting from this than not benefiting from it or... But the problem is what happens is when people like myself go away, and I'm not the only one, then somebody has to come in. And then what you do is you end up with slums and you end up with decay of the community and so on. And their long-term problems are, I think, a lot greater than what people realize.
Well, if you could just go down in that area of Hennepin and Lake Street and where George Floyd was murdered, you can just see that this is not going to be a quick fix.
No. Well, I lived in Detroit, as I think I mentioned when we started this, when I worked for IBM, my first job, and I lived in a hotel motel in Dearborn, and then we went to school downtown Detroit. And when Martin Luther King got killed, there were riots for over a week, and we didn't go to school. And when we finally did, we went by tanks and burning houses and so on. And yeah, I'll never forget that. It was a very sad time. And today it's not much better. I mean, they're finally starting to make some changes, but in the process, there's a lot of people who've gone to jail, and there's just so much corruption and so on that goes on that it concerns me. I mean, it just concerns me for my kids and my grandkids.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you investing your monies in now?
Good question. Basically, cash. That's the best investment there is.
Yeah.
at this stage. But I'm going more into passive investments in tax-friendly states or business-friendly states. Yeah, I guess would be probably a better name, because I'm in a lot of different states that have income taxes, but they're not as aggressive as what we have here in this state. And more important is the attitude towards business. I'm going into what they call fractional ownerships and DSTs, which is a Delaware statutory trust, which in layman's terms is a part of an Amazon warehouse or a Walgreens or whatever. And somebody else manages it, and you basically get dividends like you would from a stock.
Wow. Well, that is sad.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it's a sad way to finish out this aspect of your business venture.
Is. But, the good thing is it kind of woke me up, because, I was still buying properties. And if I would have been the first to pass on, before Jill, I think it would have been very difficult for her to maneuver out of this. And I always believe that for every problem, there's an opportunity. And the opportunity was that I was able to make a move while I still could make a move.
Mm-hmm. I think that's, a theme. Every problem presents some sort of an opportunity.
Exactly.
So where are you moving to?
We just signed a contract Friday to build a house in Florida, down in the Fort Myers, Naples area, and probably be done the end of next year.
Will you be sailing down there?
Not there, because it's not good sailing there in that area. You can, but it's just not. I probably jump on a plane and go down to the Caribbean someplace.
Nice. That sounds wonderful. Well, and as we close out our conversation, kind of two other things I just wanted to ask you about. You and Jill have had a long, relationship that goes back to high school sweethearts. It's a very, unique relationship to be connected that long with someone else. And you've raised three children. And how have you sustained your connection through all these different ventures and stayed really connected with each other?
Well, that's interesting. bless her soul. No, she, I'm a very headstrong person, and I only know one way to go after things. And in that process, sometimes you forget about the people around you that support you and the ones that really make it happen. At times it wasn't easy, but most of the time it wasn't easy for her. For me, I just went headstrong into things, because I am a workaholic, and that's not good or bad. It's just what I am. Probably wish I wasn't as much, but that's changing too. But one thing that kind of gets forgotten in this whole thing is that is the support staff behind you. And I would say, that she helped me in the business from the start. She answered the phone. She did all the correspondence. She did the filing. She really was my backbone, and she never really got any credit at all for doing it. And without her, I probably never could have succeeded, especially early on. I call her the glue that held it together. Okay.
Yeah.
She's extremely smart. She's organized. She's personable, and she's most important as a soulmate, and great at follow up, which was important in that business. And most of all, she was a supporting wife to, I think you mentioned, a serial entrepreneur. Okay. I think that, probably, and I hadn't thought about that before, because, you know, I'm only focused on what I'm doing now, but I went back and looked at all these things and I say, holy cow, I mean, how did I do some of that? Well, she was a big part of it. And without her, I never could have gotten even close to the success that I've been able to have.
You know, a lot of entrepreneurs are accused of being workaholics. And I will include in the show notes a quiz that you can take. It's really about the essence and the quality of the work that you're doing to determine whether or not you love your work or you are a workaholic. Because if you're a workaholic, there's something that you're not addressing in your own personal life, that the work is filling a void of that. Whereas if you're working with effervescence and toward common goals, it has a purpose and a direction, and it's a way to go after different opportunities, and you can lead a very fulfilling life by working a lot of hours. But the difference between the two, working toward a common goal and treading on the role in the field of workaholism, is that workaholism is replacing something. So, you're not addressing something that's critical in your life. Mm-hmm. And most entrepreneurs are not in that camp.
Mm-hmm.
They're obsessed about opportunities, and it's a very compelling direction that they want to go in to get it done, and they need to have that degree of passion behind it. I mean, I've known you a long time, but we haven't been in each other's lives all the time.
Right.
And so, I don't know what that is, but you can take the assessment that I'll include.
Okay, good.
And just to rule that out for yourself.
Okay, I will do that.
Yeah, but I don't
Thank
get
you.
That sense from you, because usually relationships don't survive.
Yeah, no, well, like I say, I'm just blessed to have found her early on in my life, because she's been a trooper, I guess is one way to say it.
Well, and it sounds like you also, you seem to complement each other.
Yeah, I think we do, because we're definitely both different personalities. I'm an A, and she's she's passive. I'm aggressive. We do like different things, but we like enough things that keep us together. And I guess if you both liked all the same things, you probably be pretty boring life, So
yeah, we need,
and we're not
people.
Bored, believe
right.
me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you certainly can't say that. And what are you looking forward to with this next stretch of your 2021?
Well, hopefully we get out of this goofy COVID crisis we're in.
Yeah.
But more on a personal note is, building this home down in Florida will be enjoyable. We've built other homes, but this is going to, we're really looking forward to that. I'm going to be looking forward to not having my fingers in so many different buildings as I did in the past. I still have, I have a number of buildings that I can manage without creating stress in my life at this point. I'm going to be doing more sailing, hopefully, if, like I say, if we can start to travel. And I've got a good friend down there that in Florida that fishes, and I like to fish, and so probably spend more time doing that. And most important is hopefully we get our grandchildren and children down there to spend time with us also. And we've got a lot of friends down there, so it's a great place to entertain and spend time because you're outside a lot. And hopefully we start traveling again, you know, and then managing these passive properties is basically, I got to look in the, you know, it's, when it's passive, all you do is you look and make sure you got the check at the end of the month. Okay. you don't analyze much in terms of the financials because there's nothing you can really do. Once you're in these, you're in them and you got to ride the good and the bad with it. So,
yeah.
But, no, I'm looking forward to that. And I just need to try and relax a little more. And, Joan and I bicycle. I forgot to mention that we have bikes down there. We'll probably go out for anywhere from 40 minutes to an hour and a half a day out on these recumbent bicycles.
Oh, fun.
So we get our exercise in and,
on a bicycle built for two.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't think we'll try that. But
oh, the recumbent bikes. Okay,
yeah,
those
recumbent,
are the ones where your legs are out front, in front of you.
And you're sitting in it. So
right, and in Florida, it's pretty flat, so you don't have to worry about all the hills.
Right. Well, and they're electric assist, so you do, if you need the electric to get anywhere, you can use that. You still have to pedal, but it's not as hard, and it's just a great exercise, especially for her with two artificial knees. That's the best exercise you can do because you're getting the motion and the lotion, but not the not the impact from running or walking, you know, long distances.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, great, and we'll keep in touch. I can't wait.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Lunch together.
Yes, yeah, it'll be nice.
You and Jill and Matthew and I.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you so much, Nancy, for what you do and spreading the word, because I think that basically, I know for me, is it's always listening to somebody else that's done what you're planning on doing kind of takes some of the pressure off because you see people that have done it and, you know, they've done it in their own way and you can pick an idea up here or there. Because there is no one way to do things, as we talked about. That, but the main thing is you got to take the chance, and there's never a best time. You just do it, and you make it work. Hard work and a lot of drive.
Yeah, lots of drive, and you're really fantastic with building and sustaining relationships.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So thank you so much for just really, you know, sharing your whole life with us.
Yeah, right. Well, you only know part of it, okay?
I know, right. I always keep learning more because you've got a full life.
Oh,
Yeah. Well, say hi to Jill, and I
will.
She's able to listen in on this too. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in and learning about the window of opportunities and how you can expand your ability to take advantage of different opportunities that come in front of you and analyze them in a different way. Hopefully, after you've been hearing these three conversations with Skip Thaler. And thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, Mon Frere, brother from another mother. We'll see you all next week. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become more effective as a business owner? Do you want to reinvent yourself or evolve as you redesign your business? This is a dual innovation process. Are you ready to take charge of who you next become? If the answer is yes, I've been developing and implementing mentoring programs to thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and business owners and their teams since 1992. I totally love it and feel I'm on this planet to involve the leadership in the world from the inside out. Of course, this means seeing myself as a work in progress, which is beneficial to you because I'm not stagnant and I'm motivated to create and bring you incredible programming all the time. So here's a few ways that you can get involved in our WeMentor self-leadership community. You can subscribe for free through WeMentor.com to the podcast. You can also find it on Apple Podcasts, which used to be iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, Blueberry Directory, iHeartRadio, or TuneIn Radio, which is where you can shout out your request on smart home device through Alexa, Cortana, Amazon Echo, and Google Home. You can also become a sponsor of this program and support what's happening here in these all these meaningful conversations. Or you can get one-on-one mentoring and go at your own pace as you evolve into the leader that you've always wanted to become. You can join a We Mentor Mini Lab, which we offer several times during the year. We're focused on some element of self-leadership and your progress toward becoming more effective. And the last and final way in which you can get involved in We Mentor's self-leadership community is by joining a one-year entrepreneurial leadership and mentoring lab where we dig into the details and help you with the operational along with your leadership skills so you can evolve with your entity and really, really progress in building the life that you've always wanted to build. So please check out wementor.com. You can email me, nancy@wementor.com, or call me, 1-612-804-8920. All right, keep listening, and we'll see you next week.